This is Inside Track.
The kind of insight you won't get anywhere else.
What's going to happen now that the euro is resurgent?
For an investor, are those two groups the best?
Big market moving news out of the European Central Bank this morning.
Deirdre Bolton.
Eric Schatzker.
Weekdays, 6 a.m. on Bloomberg Television.
It's time for the Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
What a special part of the Hayes Advantage this is. I've been looking forward to this interview for weeks now. Joseph Stiglitz is the 2001 Nobel Prize winner in economics. He's a professor of economics at Columbia University. But he doesn't just teach about it. He actually works it. He was the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from 95 to 97, chief economist of the World Bank from 1997 to 2000. In January of this year, Joe published a book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. It's out in paperback. He has added an afterword to look at what he saw just 10 months ago, what he sees now. He's in studio with us for the entire hour. We're thrilled to have you. Joe, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So, you know, I just want to – something that leaps out from the paperback version. You state that the financial crisis, quote, has put the world into uncharted territory, noting that the main thing about which we can be certain is we will be facing unprecedented uncertainties, which makes me – I just thought, here we are in a foreclosure mess.
Exactly. And it's sort of like a slow train wreck. Going back to 2004, 5, and 6, we were manufacturing a lot of bad mortgages, a lot of fraudulent mortgages, a lot of mortgages in which the paperwork wasn't done appropriately and they got moved around. And now we are bearing the consequences. The system, our legal system, was never designed to deal with the millions of mortgages that are going into foreclosure. It shouldn't be, because you shouldn't have an economic system in which so many people are losing their homes. So one flaw in the system exposes another problem, straining the system beyond its capacities.
Well, now We know that we had bad lending. We know now that even after all the big issues might have been settled and the banks are back on their feet, now we see these other questions about how the bank handles these. And a lot of the big banks say, we did everything fine. We're going to sort out and we're going to deal with the individual problems. Now, banks did get the big taxpayer bailout. I know they're paying it back. Nevertheless, they got the hand up despite their mistakes. Homeowners, I know some made mistakes too. They don't seem to have gotten quite as much support from the federal government. Where do we go from here?
Well, that's exactly part of the problem. Across the country, there's a sense of inequity. Those who caused the overall problem received huge amounts of money. The money was supposed to go to reinvigorate lending. Hasn't happened. Yes, the money, the lending numbers are up a little bit the last couple of months, but they're still below what the 2007 levels are. And so the money that was supposed to go to recapitalize the banks went out in dividends and out in bank bonuses. Obviously, money that's going out like that isn't going into lending. So people are angry that all this money that was justified for restarting lending didn't do that. Meanwhile, they're left holding the bag. And the irony is, of course, that the banks, who are supposed to be the financial experts, preyed on the least informed Americans. And they're left facing problems of mortgages that are underwater, owing more money than the value of their house.
Of course, the banks might say, we were relying on credit ratings agencies that ratings that didn't turn out to be valid. We didn't, you know, we big banks packaging these securities were filing everything we were supposed to. We weren't breaking the law. Yes, we may have made some mistakes, but the joinder from Wall Street is usually everybody did.
Well, not everybody did, but the real point was they were engaged in bad lending practices. They should have known it. If they didn't, they they weren't doing what they're supposed to do. I mean, after all, look, you don't have to be a genius to understand that the reason that we have loan-to-value ratios, we have lending standards, the reason why in the past you didn't lend, say, mortgages that were 95% of the value was because if mortgage the house prices go down, you're left in trouble. We had standards precisely to protect us against these mistakes. And then they threw all that aside in this, quote, new innovation.
Two-part question. First part, are you concerned that HUD, the federal government, is once again help people get mortgages with the same kind of almost non-existent loan-to-value ratio or the threat?
Yes, I am. And in fact, you know, part of this is part of the bank bailout because we have to be clear about some of the things that are going on. The low interest rates on the mortgages, unprecedentedly low interest rates, enable people to pay back the loans, and then they take out new mortgages. But the new mortgage, the risk is on the balance sheet of the government. So what we did is we took money, got the private banks off the hook, put the government on the hook. And this is another hidden part of the bailout strategy.
What would you have the federal government do now?
Well, I think we need a homeowners Chapter 11. That's one of the things I talk about in the book. You know, we have a basic principle in the corporate sector that says that when a corporation runs into trouble, it should have the right to a fresh start. And we have an expedited way of doing this because we say it's really important to maintain the integrity of the firm, to keep the jobs, to keep the enterprise going. But families are also important. Keeping people in their homes is really important, not only for the family, for the community. Kids being pulled out of school, it disrupts their education, means that we're putting in jeopardy our human capital for the future. But we aren't giving homeowners the same opportunity that we give businesses all over the country. So what I've said is when you have these mortgages that are underwater, let's give a homeowner a fresh start. Let's write down the value of the mortgage. Let's convert the debt into equity so that in the future, if they sell the home and make a capital gain, the bank gets a share of that capital gain. And this will really enable people to stay in their home. It does nobody any good to throw people out of their homes.
I am so frustrated, though. I have had many people on this show over the last year and longer talking about debt for equity swaps, Joe. And people have gone to Washington apparently to talk to people in the Treasury Department, wherever. This proposition gets nowhere. What is going on in the Obama administration that it hasn't caught fire? Many people say, well, they'll give you all the reasons, and I've got them, why it doesn't work. But many people say it will. They want to try it. But the government isn't behind it. The White House isn't behind it.
I'm afraid that they are reflecting the interests of the banks once again, because the banks don't want this because they don't want to face up to the reality that they made bad mortgages. And if they did this, they would have to face the fact that the value of the mortgage has to be written down. They'd have to write it off on their books. They'd have to get more capital. And rather than facing up to the reality, what they did is they got the accounting standards to change the standards so that they could keep on their books mortgages that are impaired as if they were perfectly fine. So the answer is they actually tried to impair the
whole process. Joe Stiglitz, I'm so glad you're here for the hour. I have the privilege of spending an entire hour today with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. His book, which came out in January of this year, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, is just out in paperback with an afterword where Joe kind of assesses this incredible 8-10 months in the U.S. economy, what's happening, how it matches up with what he thought we were going to see, and where he sees us going next. Joseph, I want to get into some of the global issues You know, as former chief economist at the World Bank, you've trotted around the world. You still do, trying to work on these things. But I want to get back to the mortgage thing because I got an email from a listener who works for a mortgage company. And he said, in regards to your criticism of the banks and the mortgage loans, he said, Dr. Stiglitz is ignoring the fact that the banks don't really own the loans. They own the servicing rights. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and private bondholders own the loans. So how could you do what you have proposed with the debt for equity swaps? I assume that's what James is asking about, on these existing contractual obligations.
Well, you can pass a law. We have bankruptcy laws that provide the legal backdrop. So it's basically, you can think of this as a reform in the bankruptcy law that would say you could go to a court and say, I'm sorry, I have difficulty paying this. This mortgage is underwater. We treat the home as if it were a separate enterprise, and it's underwater. And so we need a fresh start. So this is a legal remedy, and there are obviously legal issues involved. But the notion of a debt equity swap may be sweetened by government money. Remember,
which is like the Chris Mayer and Glenn Hubbard proposal, both from Columbia.
Exactly. And remember, we gave so much money to the big banks in the hope that some of it would trickle down to the rest of the economy. It didn't do that. What this is would be, let's get some of the money down at the bottom, and maybe it'll trickle up.
That's a great idea. I love it. Okay. Global issues, as promised. Mervyn King from the Bank of England saying that the G20 needs a grand bargain. He's concerned about the competitive devaluations. We see that with the dollar. Concerned that other countries who have free-floating currencies now are calling this a war and making Brazil putting on capital controls. Can we still get a grand bargain, Joe? It seems to me that right now everybody's out for themselves.
You're absolutely right. And let me try to put this in context. What everybody had hoped, what the United States had hoped, is that we could get out of this downturn by export. After all, in the 97-98 global financial crisis, Korea, Thailand, Indonesia got out of it partly by exports. Very big difference, though, when you have a problem in small country and the rest of the world is strong, and the situation where you have the problem in two big areas, the United States and Europe, they can't export to the rest of the world because the rest of the world is just too small for the basis of a really strong recovery. Now, in that context, some of what is going on has reverberations of back to the Great Depression. In that period, remember, we had beggar thy neighbor policies where we tried to strengthen our economy at the expense of others. You can't do that because of the WTO, but the weapon of choice today is a competitive devaluation. If I can make my exchange rate weak, then I can resist imports. But of course, not everybody can weaken their currency relative to others. Exchange rates are relative prices. So in a way, you can think about exchange rates, I think of it as a negative beauty contest. We've been engaged with others to say which country has the worst economic policy. For a while, the U.S. was winning. Then Europe is doing a little bit better. Now the United States is weak. But what we're doing is going beyond that. The flood of money coming out of our central bank is not going to reinvigorate the American economy, or at least a very large portion, is going abroad. Right. They're asking, where are the best investment opportunities? And it's in the emerging markets. The emerging markets don't want this short-term money. They know what has happened in the past.
98, the Asian economic crisis.
Exactly. Money goes in, money goes out. But in the short run, your exchange rate goes up. And they said, no, thank you. What they're doing is, as you said, taxes, capital controls, and direct intervention. So what is happening is, rather than gaining exports, what we're doing is fragmenting the global market, increasing volatility, and that's not good for the global recovery.
The G20 finance ministers meeting this week in South Korea, there's speculation they may be preparing an accord on currencies and exchange rates. Do you see this happening?
I think one can see a form of words where they say, oh, let's all be nice to each other. The real question is exchange rates are affected by so many different variables. So, for instance, let me give you an example. The United States will never say that it's engaged in a competitive devaluation. What it will say is we're engaged in quantitative easing because short-term interest rates are down to zero. We can't do anything about that. The Fed caused the problem back in creating the bubble. And now all we're trying to do is repair the mess that we made, trying to get the economy going again. But we all know that the major channel through which monetary policy exercises its effect is that the low interest rates leads to a weak dollar. So the secret is this is a competitive devaluation. No matter what the words are, everybody knows this is the strategy.
Big rally in stocks today. Federal Reserve has been so much a part of this stock market rally in the sense that the vast majority on Wall Street are convinced the Fed will announce some kind of quantitative easing plan, QE2, they call it, because the Fed's done a lot of it already. Meets November 2nd and 3rd. That's why the Beige Book closely watched today. Joe Stiglitz, did you ever expect there'd be more QE2 in the pipeline?
Well, I think what is so clear is that the Fed, having created the problem in the first place, feels guilty, feels it ought to be doing something. It misestimated the magnitude of the problem, except things were contained when they weren't, and now would like to do something. So my heart goes out to them. I'm glad they're trying to do something. The reality is there's very little that they can do. Short-term interest rates are down to zero. Quantitative easing is designed to lower long-term interest rates. Broad consensus is that at most they could lower long-term interest rates, maybe 0.2, 0.3%, but that is not going to have a significant effect on the real economy.
Is it your expectation on all the speeches you've heard, read? I know you've just barely had a chance to kind of glance at this Beige Book, but we got a great summary from our Washington Fed team, ECO team. Is it your sense that this is going to play into the decision on QE2 at the next meeting? Does the Fed expect to do it? Do you expect to see it?
Yeah, I do expect to see it, but I don't think, and let me just say, it's going to have much effect. And, you know, the report sort of highlights the two-sided nature. They think things are a little bit better, but then you look beneath the surface and you'll see reports like the fact that while housing starts are up, they're one-third of what they were before the crisis. So, you know, what we're talking about is just little changes at the margin. No hope at all that we're going to see a tripling of housing starts, which is what we would need to go back to where we were. So the fact is the economy is sick.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why Wall Street expects more quantitative easing is because they're looking at inflation and it may fall a bit more in this cycle. And the Fed apparently suggesting, in terms of their mandate, price stability and keeping, you know, trying to lower unemployment, that they also have to keep inflation from falling too much, which might be the same thing as saying we want more inflation. Now, you're an advocate of equality. How worried are you about a central bank that is trying to create higher inflation, because we know that inflation hits the lowest sectors of the society hardest because prices can go up faster than wages?
Well, let me parse that in a couple parts. First, one of the problems that the Fed got into before the crisis is this excessive focus on interest rates. They thought there's a simple tool they have. Inflation too high, you raise interest rates. As long as inflation is not too high, you lower interest rates. They forgot all about what else was going on in the economy. For instance, financial fragility, a bubble. They're back to this excessive focus on interest rates as if changing the interest rate is going to solve all the problems. Now, the fact is, whether they think inflation is too high or too low, lowering the interest rate, the long-term interest rate, is not really going to have any significant dent either in the real level of economic activity or on the level of inflation. So you don't have to be worried about this starting inflation. Maybe that's what they want to do, but the impact on the real sector, given the gap in the jobs deficit, the weakness in the labor market, it's not going to happen.
Is it possible, though, that maybe some of the inflation data? David Malpass, in a recent op-ed, he's a former Bear Stearns economist. He now has his NCMA advisors. That maybe some of these inflation data could be revised higher over time. And that is that a concern?
Not really. I'm not sure what he was trying to get at.
It happened to the readings in 2003, 2004. Subsequently, inflation was higher than we thought.
Yeah. But the point I want to make is that what really matters for the stability of our economy right now is that Americans, so many Americans, are over-leveraged. They owe more money than the value of their house, and wages, incomes, is what is really relevant to their ability to pay back what they owe. Wages are not doing well. And a report that came out yesterday, median incomes, median wages are not doing well. And so no matter how you measure, you know.
So you don't see an inflationary pressure from wages. So therefore, you don't think of a problem there. And you're confident in the Fed's ability once the economy does recover and maybe we do get some more inflation pressures that the Fed will be able to stop it, stop and fire inflation from happening.
Let me just say, I'm not confident in anything that the Fed does. If you look at their past history, I don't know why any reason why anybody would feel very confident. But what I think is true is that they have instruments by which they can dampen the economy if they want to. My real worry is actually that they will be overly exuberant because of their worries about inflation and step on the brake too hard and going into a dip, double, triple, quadruple dip recession.
Wow. That is another interesting worry. You can worry about this thing so many different ways, Joe. We're going to continue. As I said, we have Joe Stiglitz for the entire hour, Nobel Prize winning economist. On the day the Beige Book comes out, what's better than that? I got to tell you. We want to talk more about solutions, what Joe Stiglitz thinks we should do to reduce unemployment. He's already says he has great misgivings about the currency devaluation strategy, which he says the Fed is pursuing. And how can you get – banks already have lots of liquidity. They're not lending. You know, how can we get them to do that? Regarding the Fed and quantitative easing, there's another question I must ask you on that, because – for quantitative easing to work, quote unquote, it has to stimulate the real economy. And one idea would be that you put more liquidity in the system, more capital, and the banks start lending, right? But we already see banks sitting on piles of excess reserves. So what is that going to do? And does it just kind of raise the question of the Fed's done all it can? Now we have to turn to fiscal policy.
Exactly. We do have to turn to fiscal policy. You know, giving them a little bit more money to sit on, they'll just sit on it. There are two kinds of firms in the United States right now. There are the lot of large enterprises that themselves are sitting on piles of cash. If the long-term interest rate lower by 0.2%, 0.3%, they're not going to go out and invest that cash that they're already sitting on. Meanwhile, the small and medium-sized enterprises are really starving for money. But here, it's the banking system that's not functioning well. The uncertainty, even when there are good banks that are able to lend, they see just so much uncertainty in our macroeconomy.
So what should be done now, Joe?
What we really need, a second round of stimulus. I'm afraid we're not going to get it, but we really, really need.
What would you do? How would you get people to hire?
Well, if the government tries to give some more money to the stakes. Remember, go back to the September jobs report. The private sector added 67,000 jobs, but the public sector, and particularly state and local governments, were letting off workers so that the net loss was 95,000 jobs.
Okay.
Now, if you gave money to the stakes, they would be able to keep those employees. Those employees would then spend money. Those would buy goods
sure.
and services. That income would mean that there'd be more confidence in businesses, and that would generate investment. So what we'd really do is have to get the economy
okay.
going. And unfortunately, what we're doing is contracting, not expanding.
Got about four things I want to ask you, so I want to really do a little lightning round here. One argument is that CEOs don't hire because the stock market rewards them for keeping their costs low. Do we need to change the model where the American CEO is rewarded through the financial system? So they're dancing to Wall Street's tune.
Well, one of the fundamental problems with the American economy is what we call short-termism. Quarterly returns, you focused on the here and now rather than the long-term. Unfortunately, that's not going to change anytime soon. So that's not going to be a remedy for the economy's current malaise.
Now, I want to look at China because China raised its key rate this week. Again, we've got this meeting in South Korea of the finance ministers. There'll be a heads of state in November. China, as you said, they can say we are currency manipulators because of our quantitative easing. But are we closer maybe to some kind of accord between the U.S. and China?
Well, I don't think so, because it's so natural when a country has, U.S., caused a global problem, reached political gridlock in the main effective instrument, fiscal policy, turning now to monetary policy, which everybody knows one of the main channels is competitive devaluation, called currency manipulation. It's going to be very difficult to get a global consensus. China, meanwhile, says, look, if we change our exchange rate significantly, we have a lot of firms that could go into bankruptcy. Won't be good for our economy, but by the way, it's not going to be good for the global economy. If we have a significant slowdown, we are the only source of global growth affecting Latin America, Africa. And so not only the direct, but the secondary reverberations will be very bad. And look at what we did between 2005 and 2008. We let our currency go up 20% and our trade surplus increased. Your trade deficit worsened. So the fact is, letting a significant change in the exchange rate is bad for the global economy and won't solve the problem of global imbalances.
Do we risk a dollar crisis?
I don't think we risk a dollar crisis right now, but I think we ought to put it in context. We almost take for granted the stability of the dollar, although it's been declining almost steadily. But back in early 1970s, we did have a dollar crisis, and it could happen again. So I don't put a high probability on it, but I don't think we should put it out of our mind.
If the Fed is pursuing really a currency devaluation strategy to boost exports, why won't it talk about it?
Well, obviously, because we're engaged in accusing others of currency manipulation. What they are going to say is, we're not doing it for that reason. We're doing it because we want to boost the American economy. And there may be some grain of truth in that, but if you then start pressing Fed officials or other advocates of quantitative easing, you ask them, how else is it going to work? It's not going to lead to the big firms lending. We all agreed about that. We talked about not going to lead to very much increase of lending to small businesses, given the problems already in America's economy. They talk about maybe creating another bubble. Real estate bubble, commodity
right.
bubble, that's really not the way to get us back to sustainable growth. And even if we created an equity bubble or a bond bubble, that's not going to translate into substantially more consumption or investment. And that leaves the major channel, exports.
Yes. Is China risking a bubble? Is China facing too much inflation? Do you have any concerns about the Chinese economy?
Well, China has been worried about bubbles internally, and I think that's one of the reasons that they're raising the interest rate. But again, like I've criticized the Fed for excessive focus on the interest rate, there are many other instruments. China also has many other instruments that are probably more important that, and they ought to be using some of those other instruments. Capital controls, they already have that, but taxes on capital gains, taxes that would discourage short-term capital inflows and outflows, which are so destabilizing for economies, that we learned in the 97-98 crisis. I hope we don't have to relearn that lesson in solving America's problem today. We cause another global crisis of the kind that we've had before.
Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, thank you so much for joining us in studio today on The Hayes Advantage.
Nice to be here.
And I want to remind everybody the book is out in paperback, and it's got a new afterword, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy by Joseph E. Stiglitz. Thank you so much. So what could be better than having Joe Stiglitz and Henry Kaufman? Henry Kaufman, of course, is one of the legendary figures of Wall Street. He was, when I started in this business some 20-odd years ago, he was chief economist at Salomon Brothers, which was at that time one of the most dominant firms on Wall Street and certainly in the bond area. He is now president of Henry Kaufman and Co., which he has been for several years. And it's an especially special day. Henry Kaufman, happy birthday.
Thank you very much. The news does get around.
It does. And again, it just makes it all the more, again, more terrific that you're on the show with us today. And as a birthday present to yourself, I guess, you wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, I did.
Bernanke's inflation target misses the mark. So you are concerned, and it's laid out step by step, that the Fed risks not just a little more inflation that might be healthy for the economy, but something that's more like an inflation problem.
Well, I think the Fed invites an inflation problem eventually with that procedure. I do not believe the Federal Reserve should set a target for inflation. We have a condition today where we have no inflation. But in order to deal with a sagging and lagging economy, I think it's appropriate for the Fed to be aggressive, to inject reserves, to buy coupon issues or longer-dated obligations. But in no way should it set a target for future inflation that would be acceptable. 2% rate of inflation over a period of time is a very serious rate of inflation, because it diminishes the purchasing power of the dollar.
Well, but Henry, it does. But for example, Joe Stiglitz was on, and his view is that the Fed is deliberately weakening the dollar, and they are part and parcel of a competitive currency devaluation strategy in order to boost exports. Is that sort of the 800-pound gorilla, the elephant in the room for the Fed?
Well,
the dollar?
I don't think. The big problem for the Federal Reserve is the very slow growth in the American economy, the high unemployment rate, and the extent to which it tries to combat that by having an aggressive monetary policy. It, of course, it affects the value of the dollar in the foreign exchange markets. As I've said at earlier times in the past couple of months, I do think the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury is willing to accept a lower value for the dollar as long as that decline in the value of the dollar proceeds at an orderly pace. And so far, that is what has occurred.
Well, the Fed, it's always officially stated that the Fed doesn't, you know, really talk about the dollar. And many Wall Street economists say, oh, the Fed doesn't try to weaken the dollar. They just lower interest rates. And then it's supposed to be sort of a secondary impact. The dollar weakens and boosts exports. But would it be useful for the Fed to talk more specifically, for Ben Bernanke to talk more specifically to this point that, yes, we are weakening the dollar to boost exports?
Well, he would probably say it differently. I assume he would say that the Fed has a responsibility to be supportive of economic growth in the United States. And in order to support economic growth here, under current conditions, the Fed has to supply a huge volume of reserves, buy government securities in large amounts, and that can indirectly hurt the value of the dollar in the foreign exchange markets. It is a byproduct, but not the direct objectives of monetary policy.
What about, Henry, and I want to walk through your 6 points, but are you concerned about the strong momentum that inflation can get once it starts moving up? Are you concerned that once inflation is on the move in a recovering economy, that the Fed won't be able to stop it?
Well, you're close to what I thought I would try to say, and that is once the inflation rate rises and the Fed has a 2% target in that rate of inflation, how long does it wait to pull back on the monetary reins? Does it do it instantaneously, or does it say, well, these may be temporary factors that are contributing to the rate of inflation? Let's wait another quarter or two quarters or three quarters to really see what's happening. And in the interim, then, the rate of inflation goes up, and we are stuck with a higher rate of inflation. And as you know, once the rate of inflation picks up, there are all kinds of political pressures for a while not to have monetary policy tighten. So the responsiveness of the Federal Reserve would have to be far better than it has been in the post-World War II periods, at times when the rate of inflation did pick up. In the 1970s, the rate of inflation rose dramatically, and consumer prices by the end of the 70s were running at an annual rate of 15% increase before the Fed fully responded with a lot of alacrity and determination. But those were the days in which Paul Volcker had to come in and put an end to the process.
You also point out that this, not exactly inflation-specific target maybe, but this sense that the Fed would say, we want some higher inflation, and you're calling it their inflation targeting process, that
right.
It would be predicated, like what people say, well, how much inflation does the Fed want? And you point out that it would be hinged on their summary of economic projections, where they give their three-year view of inflation, and then we would implicitly say, oh, that's where the Fed wants inflation. But you wisely point out, you know, the Federal Reserve's track record on forecasting, like a lot of people, not to pick on them, is not always so great.
Well, for example, back in October 2007, the Federal Open Market Committee and the Fed estimated that by the fourth quarter of 2009, the unemployment rate would be 4.8 to somewhere to 4.9% in the fourth quarter of, and in the fourth quarter of 2010, the unemployment rate would be 4.7 to 4.9%. But we all know that was way, way off the mark. So where is this great mechanism which the Fed has that can quickly adjust to changing economic conditions and can really accurately forecast what is going to happen in the next couple of years? It has not been able to do that. Many private forecasters certainly haven't been able to do that, but it is the Fed that regulates the supply of money, the growth of reserves, and therefore that is supposed to have an impact on economic behavior, but it doesn't have the model that assures this kind of accuracy.
Henry, is it your view that the Federal Reserve, when it comes out of its two-day meeting on November 3rd, will announce some kind of substantial quantitative easing program?
Well, Kathleen, I think that is pretty much baked in the cake by now, considering all the discussions that have taken place, the presentations by the chairman Bernanke, other Federal Reserve officials. I think the chairman has the vote to get that kind of support for that kind of action. The issue really is what will be the magnitude of those purchases, over what period of time, and to some extent to what maturity range will this be aimed at. I would assume it'll be aimed at somewhere between 10 years and out to 30 years. But I think it's very critical for the Fed to give us an idea of how much it will purchase and for how long it will purchase. I think the issue really is, if it's going to do it, it's got to show this determination. And it cannot be modest about it. Otherwise, the market just isn't going to accept what the Fed would like to achieve.
Are you talking about, you say, 10 to 30 years? Are you talking about government bonds, mortgage-backed securities? Okay, good old-fashioned U.S. Treasuries.
I think I would believe that it will try to buy U.S. government obligations, because it has had some experience now with private sector obligations like mortgage securities, and that gets it into the private sector. And I believe the Fed would probably prefer to stay in the U.S. government area.
All right. Henry Kaufman will continue. It's his birthday. He's got an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. We want to continue to look at his critique of the Fed following a higher inflation policy, next on Bloomberg Radio. Henry Kaufman, president of Henry Kaufman and Company, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today where he argues that Bernanke's inflation target misses the mark. The more latitude the Fed has to try to spur economic growth, the more economic uncertainty there will be. Again, a bit of a birthday present to Henry Kaufman, and we want to again extend you congratulatory wishes, Henry.
Thank you.
And you have said, I really appreciated that you just spelled out so clearly your view. Quantitative easing will happen. You think it needs to be big. The Fed needs to have a commitment over time. It will be government bonds, 10 to 30 years, et cetera. What will it accomplish besides help Wall Street make more money, because they're going to be,
Well, I think it will at least marginally do the following: a decline in the yield on long governments and, for example, on 10-year obligations will at least marginally encourage more homeowners to refinance existing mortgages and therefore lower their financing costs. Secondly, it will at least marginally, again, help perhaps some people who want to buy a new home. Thirdly, I would suspect that in some ways it will encourage the banks, at least, to work a little bit harder to make business loans. All of that doesn't necessarily mean the economy will be turned around, but it will help. The other factor is that the chances are this kind of intervention should boost financial asset values and may boost stock prices, and therefore the financial wealth of households would be going up. As you remember, the second quarter figures that were released a little while ago showed that household wealth actually had been declining. So the extent to which that household wealth would be going up, it will improve at least expectations and sentiment in the consumer sector to some extent.
If there's going to be such a marginal impact from it, why are we doing more monetary policy action, quantitative easing? Is it time for the Treasury Department, for the White House, for the Congress to take some more targeted actions that could spur companies to hire? Some have talked about a payroll tax holiday. Again, monetary policy, limited impact. Fiscal policy, is maybe that where the action should be?
Well, if we had a meaningful fiscal policy program immediately ahead of us, that would be helpful. But as you know very well, there's an election coming up in a couple of weeks. There's the potential of a standstill in fiscal policy actions, a Congress that will be divided rather than united. It will be very difficult to quickly put forth further fiscal stimulus programs, whether it has to do with tax reductions or whether it has to do with enlarging some spending programs. The chances are modest that we will get action by the Congress quickly. And by quickly, I'm talking about in the next couple of months, considering the debate that will ensue. The chances of any legislation is passed to stimulate the economy before it really is in place will be in the second quarter of next year. And that's a long time.
Henry, as you look to the, well, we have the G20 20 finance ministers gathering in South Korea. There'll be a heads of state meeting in early November.
Right.
Are you concerned that maybe the spirit of coordination we had during the financial crisis has been lost? We have these competitive currency devaluations, some would say. We have China raising rates. We have a lot of, you know, Mervyn King from the Bank of England saying we need a, you know, a grand plan, right?
Yes.
Are we going to get anywhere with this?
Well, I doubt that we will get very much. I think a communique will be issued, which will try to put everything in the best of light. As you recall, of course, when we had a financial crisis, we were pretty well all in it, more or less. Europe certainly was very much in the crisis. We were a little, much less so in the Far East, but there was more of a unity to do things. Now, of course, the issue is on trade, is on currency, and there is significant division in this sector that will be very difficult to reconcile, but particularly since a lot of it involves what China will do. China has just raised interest rates again. It may raise interest rates some more, but the indications are that these issues are not going to resolve.
So what does that leave the global economy, Henry? What's going to happen to us?
Well, the global economy will continue to be bifurcated. Bifurcated in the sense our growth will be slow. European economic growth will be very slow. Japan will struggle to get its economy in growing.
Okay.
And that leaves the so-called the Far East, China, India, some of the other, Singapore, Hong Kong, and so on. Those countries doing better. Latin America probably will do somewhat better. And that is a bifurcated situation. And at the extent to which I should add that we will pursue an accommodating monetary policy, and I think Europe, this will provide a lot of financial resources for those developing countries because some of that money will continue to move offshore.
Okay. Well, Henry Kaufman, actually, you gave us a birthday present, even though it's your birthday. Thanks for joining us on the Hayes Advantage today.
It's very nice to be with you.
Henry Kaufman is president at Henry Kaufman & Co. He's got an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today on Bernanke and inflation. This is it for the Hayes Advantage.
Copyright Bloomberg LP 2010.